Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. My very special guest is a veteran, the grand lady of Chicago theater, Roslyn Alexander. Say hello, Roslyn.
Hello, and hello, Tom. Thanks for those kind words.
Tell us about The Passion of Emma Goldman. It is a, I must say, it is a major accomplishment for you. You wrote the show and you star in it for 90 minutes and you tell the life of a great, I won't say great, but let's say an infamous American.
Well, she was, but she had many facets to her character, and that's what drew me to her. First of all, I want to tell you, I really didn't write the show. I adapted her autobiography, but I validated my own ideas by doing research what other people had written about her. So when I read a little bit about her one day, not knowing much about Emma Goldman, to me she was what everybody thought of, an anarchist, an activist, a crazy bomb thrower, a dangerous woman. And the fact that she was deported, I thought she must have been a real tough old bird who was making trouble. Well, I happened to read a little piece about her once that said she was a party girl. She loved drink and music and men and fun, and she had a wonderful sense of humor. And I thought, how unusual to have all these facets in one personality who was known for one thing only, and that was her violence. So I decided to read more about her, and I fell in love with the character. I thought, would I love to play a character like that? But who was going to give me the part? Where was the play? So I decided to do it myself. I've had a lot of experience doing solo performances.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I was a young mother, in those days, nice women didn't leave their husbands and children at night to go be at a play. It wasn't considered nice. Now, you know, young people can't understand that things have changed so much in one lifetime.
Well, Renee Matthews also said that. She had
absolutely
to wait years
and
to
Ann
raise
Whitney.
It. Ann Whitney.
We all had to be wives and mothers until our children were old enough to be independent so we could follow our dream. Well, now, I had been a radio actress as a teenager, and I worked until I was a bride. But once you're a bride, you accept a different way of life. Not resentfully, but that's the path for young women in those days. So I did what I could while my children were young, whatever I could do daytimes. I did what we learned at Northwestern University as interpretive reading or chamber theater. I did a whole three-act play with all the characters myself.
Wow.
And people thought, oh, how can that be done? It's impossible. Then they'd see it and they'd tell me they were so surprised that they saw the whole play in front of their eyes. You see, people's imaginations do so much that we don't trust that anymore. We have to have all the visuals. Remember radio?
Yeah. And I agree. The theater is about imaginations.
Yes.
Two people in a black box can create.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So I had a lot of experience doing that. I traveled all over the Midwest. I had an agent. But I required that I had to go somewhere where I could be home that night. I could fly home that night. Now, why would I put such a restriction on myself? It sounds ridiculous today. But those were the values we lived by. Mm-hmm. A nice woman didn't stay in a hotel by herself. Can you believe that?
No, that's...
that's true.
Okay.
So I had that behind me that I knew I could do it. And then when I fell in love with this character, I thought, this is the time for me to work on a solo performance. It's becoming more in vogue now than it used to be to have solo performances. And I love the character. So even if I would never have had a production, God forbid, I would have loved doing it. It was a labor of love. I learned much about America, and there was much to be ashamed of in those days. The robber barons, before income tax, before unions, people were so exploited, especially the poor immigrants who came to this country. They were dreadfully exploited, working 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day. In order to get a job at a sweatshop, you had to own and maintain your own machine.
That was something I didn't know. And no wonder she was part of an immigrant group who were exploited in the old country. And when they came here, they decided not there. Not here. We're going to take a stand.
Yeah, they thought, well, they thought it was be the golden America, you know. And when they saw the things were the same, they knew they had to fight for their rights. And they needed leaders like Emma Goldman and Mother Jones and the men who became our union leaders, Sidney Hillman, Dubinsky. It's a pantheon of them.
A lot of them were Jewish immigrants.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Because, you see, the largest union in the country were the ladies' garment workers.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And most, yes, for many years, okay. Until the 40s.
Okay.
Or longer than that, I think it was the 60s, they were the largest one because of the needle trades in New York. Mm-hmm. But most of the employees were Jews and Italians. Those were the people that came with the skill to for tailoring and sewing. So they were the main workers, and they organized, and they it took a lot of courage, because it was worth your life to be in a labor march. You could get shot down.
Yeah, they hired the Pinkertons a lot to break them up, and they were
the National Guard fired on workers. The militias were called out. And you see, big business ran the country.
Yeah, that's true.
Who was the president who said, the business of America is business? Was that Coolidge?
I think it was.
Yeah.
Harding or Coolidge, one of those two losers.
So you see, they influenced the newspapers, big business, mm-hmm. advertising.
Sure.
And they had the money, and they had the power. So it needed strong leadership to fight that environment.
And Emma Goldman certainly was. She was a great orator, from what I understand.
Yes, right? She had a gift for that. And she drew more crowds than any speaker in the country. And this is when public speaking outdoors was very big. The Chautauqua.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And all the presidential candidates, how they campaigned.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And she could do it. She had the voice. She had the charisma.
She also spoke five languages from,
well, you know, most Europeans speak more than one or two languages.
Yeah, but she had a real gift for language.
She had a gift for communication. People were drawn to her. And Emma herself would absolutely lay down her life for her ideals. To her, anarchism was an ideal.
But explain what you do in the play so well, what she meant by anarchism, because she wasn't a bomb thrower. She was a pacifist, you point
out. She was a pacifist, and most anarchists were. The anarchist rule was nonviolence. Now, in every movement, there are a couple of loose cannons. You don't find them anywhere. But they did not believe in violence. They believed that they could change government. They could change society. Well, we're still fighting about the same things that Emma Goldman fought for then. We're still fighting for women's rights and birth control and homosexuals' liberty and labor unions.
Equal pay, also.
Equal pay. Yeah. But the same things that she was fighting for. You know, one of the funny lines in the play is she doesn't believe if women got the vote that anything would change. She said they still wouldn't be paid equally. They'd still be oppressed.
Well, she knew what was coming, didn't she?
She said if voting changed anything, they'd make it illegal.
Yeah, that's right.
she was not a dreamy-eyed person. She was very realistic, but passionate about her views. And you asked me something before.
About her passion and how she was this political activist, but she also had a passion. She had a couple of men in her life, too.
Oh, a couple.
Yeah. Well,
I didn't even mention, because it would have been almost ludicrous, you know. Mm-hmm. Men were attracted to her. And this is what's so interesting. She was not good looking.
I was going to say that. She looked like Mary in the Librarian, yeah.
Worse. Yeah. By the time she was in her middle 30s, she had gained weight. She was dowdy. Mm-hmm. She looked like a grandmother who was deprived.
Okay. At a young age.
Yeah. But her charisma must have been outstanding because young men adored her and followed her and gave up their careers to work for her. I think a lot of it was due to her maternal qualities. She took care of people. And I think it's one thing the younger men loved about her. They needed that mothering that she gave them.
All men need that.
Yeah, you're right.
I'll confess.
You're right. And she must have had some kind of an appeal that you don't notice if you look at her, but it must have been something in her personality, her charm, that attracted men.
Okay. So now tell us about the structure of your play, because you do it on two levels. You tell her story historically, and you also give us a vivid depiction of her as a person and her dual passions, I'll call them.
Well, maybe because of the work I've done before, as I explained, doing three-act shows with all the characters, it seemed to me only natural that if you're talking about somebody, about what they did or a scene that they played in their lives, do the scene. Don't just tell about it.
Well, that you do the
Become
scene
it.
And you and your great use of photography. Where'd you get the photos?
They're published. Okay. You can find them in any library, books about her.
Doing your homework, huh?
Yeah, yeah. there were probably a lot more, but we tried to be selective and just show a few so it wouldn't look like a slideshow. But it's interesting that the men in her life, you know, on the screen, they all have beards.
Yeah.
And tall, strong-looking men, you know, that guided her in her early life. But I can't talk about somebody without becoming that person. I think I get it from my mother. My mother was a wonderful mimic. And she did not do mimicry consciously. But when she would tell you about somebody that she met, she would lapse into that person's diction and mannerisms.
Naturally,
Yeah.
Wow.
And, well, we have wonderful raconteurs in our family. They're storytellers, and they're very good at it. And I think I just grew up with that feeling that don't tell us about it. Show us. Mm-hmm. So I love telling a story and then doing the scene from the story.
I mean, so you look like him, you sound like him. I mean,
well, thank you.
I ended up seeing a lot of these people.
Well, that's just what you're
And you were the only one on the stage, so that you did your job.
That's very nice to hear, because that's our job when we're portraying characters. People don't think it can be done. But as I said, all you need is a little imagination. And if I change my posture, you see somebody older.
Mm-hmm.
Or somebody younger. Or a male instead of a female.
But you know, one of the most outstanding things, and I think a couple of the reviewers pointed it out too, was we could see her Emma Goldman's passion in your eyes.
Ah.
Thank you. The charismatic sparkle in the eyes really emphasized the point.
I was focusing on Emma. I'll tell you a little secret. my daughter. I have two daughters and a son, all grown, of course. But my youngest daughter said, "Mom, don't worry about your performance. You are Emma Goldman." I don't know how to take that.
Yeah, was that a compliment or a dig, right? Did she explain?
I know what she meant.
Okay.
That's another thing about acting. You don't have to have had the experience that your character has had. But there are experiences in your life that you can compare and learn from. For instance, I was never in a riot. You know, I never spoke to 1,000 people outside urging them to fight for their rights. But I do remember caring enough to try and convince somebody of something. Mm-hmm. And you just take that and use it.
You go to that place and bring it.
Yes. So when she said, "Mom, you are Emma Goldman," I knew she didn't mean I lived the life of Emma Goldman, but I could be passionate. I could be funny. I do love fun. So she felt that it would be scary or hard for me to assume that persona.
But it's craft in something you've
done. Oh, yes.
So tell us about how you worked with Denis Zajac, one of our great directors.
Well, Denis and I have become great friends over the years because I did maybe, I don't know, 6 or 7 shows for him when he was at Victory Gardens. And early in his career when he directed for other theaters, I worked for him also. And over the years, we always had a professional relationship, but not intimate or personal. However, I had such great respect for the way he directs. He is the most nourishing director.
That's what everybody tells me, yeah.
Yeah.
Who's worked for
him. He's kind. He knows how to shape your performance, but not by being critical, but just by suggesting the right questions to ask yourself. And he's just a very nice man. So when I told him what I was doing, and I would be so proud if he would consider directing it, and when he agreed at once, I was thrilled. And it's been a very comfortable relationship, and we've become special friends as a result, I'm happy to say.
And it's, from what I'm hearing you say after the words, is he made you comfortable in doing the role.
Yes. He made me feel that it's within my reach, easily within my reach.
Did it scare you doing this? I mean, you're 90 minutes telling a major story by yourself.
No, it didn't.
Okay.
It didn't scare me. I have that same kind of excitement. You know, even if I had a small role in a play, there's that, you know, the butterflies. Mm-hmm. And of course, I've had the butterflies. No, the only thing I worried about was maybe it was too long, but it was impossible to cut anymore. We had cut.
I didn't think
many
it was
things.
Too long.
And well, that's what I've heard.
Yeah.
And that comforts me so much because everybody said, other directors, oh, you can't do a solo show over 70 minutes, 80 minutes. You can't do a solo show for 90 minutes. But I figured to have the integrity of the script, we had to use that much.
And plus, I don't know where those directors were. I mean, Lemmon's son just did it. Has a show going, it's 90 minutes. Hersey Felder's made a career out of 90-minute shows.
But you see, they're celebrities.
Well, and you're a celebrity in this town.
Well, thank you. But that I worried about. However, from the first night on, from our first preview on, you could hear a pin drop. Nobody coughed. Nobody whispered. Nobody wiggled in their seat. So I thought either they're all dead or they're really interested. And that been my...
So actors, you can tell on stage.
Oh, yes. Yeah. You can feel the audience. Yeah. In fact, you know, there's sometimes, if you have a very small house, the show takes longer because you're pushing them to understand.
Yeah. You know? You're reaching to
them. You're feeding them by the spoonfuls. But when you have a larger and a responsive audience, as I've had, it just sails by. Somebody asked me, does that feel like 90 minutes when you're up there? Oh, no, it doesn't. I mean, it goes by very fast. And I'm now I don't worry about that anymore, about being long.
Technical question that I always wonder about, and I always ask this people do one person plays. How do you cue yourself going from scene to scene? I know some people, Timothy Edward Cain told me when he did the Odyssey, that he would move, you know, they had movements on, he'd climb up the stairs, and that meant he was at a certain point.
Oh, that's a very good way to do it, kinesthetically.
Okay.
If I should forget a line, but I'm headed for the desk, I know that that line, you know, it comes to me because
you anchor things by your movement.
Not even consciously. It just happens. Let me tell you a little story very fast. I had a friend who was coaching Ginger Rogers when she appeared at Marriott, I think it was. And she couldn't remember lines. She was advanced in age and she could not remember her lines. Well, so this young lady was told to coach her at home. She coached and coached and coached and it wasn't sinking in. And then this young lady reflected, Ginger Rogers was a dancer.
Sure
was. Let's attach it to movement. And then she remembered her lines.
Wow.
Instead of just reading the script and trying to remember it, you walked through it and she did all the movements and then she remembered the lines.
Do you use similar techniques?
Well, that is a very helpful technique. I do a lot of word association because that's one thing that's hard about a one-person show. You're not acting off of other people who can throw you a cue, you know.
Right. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That makes it inherently more difficult.
So I have these little word tricks, ending as either there's a sentence I end with the word. I think it's a short word. See, now I can't even think of it because I'm not in the scene. It's a short word and it's got a long O.
Okay.
Like hold.
Okay.
And I know the next little episode starts with an O.
Okay.
One I was having trouble with. After I mentioned her being buried in the cemetery at Waldheim, I pick up a card from the box and I was always losing it. And the card is, I say, this is funny. They asked me a funny question. Those are the questions in the box that I use. Dennis said, cemetery, funny. Oh, sure. I'll never forget it now. The contrast, yeah.
It's I just enjoyed the show so much. Give us a little commercial for it. You're at the State 773 until
June 1st.
And then you go to up the Skokie, right?
The Skokie Theater.
That's the one on Lincoln Avenue. Yeah, I've been there a little.
Used to be the movie theater.
Yeah, it's nice.
And we're going to be there for 3 weekends, Thursday through Sunday. Maybe we start Wednesdays there. I'm not sure. Because I don't believe we play Friday night in Skokie.
Right. You do play Wednesday because I on my reviews, I always put up.
Right.
And you don't play on Friday
night. Friday night, no. So that will be from June 4th till June 22nd. So there's 3 weekends there and 2 more weekends here in Chicago.
Okay.
And so far we've had great responses. I'm very grateful for the responses we've had from the audience and from people who've called me that I haven't heard from or knew they were around anymore, telling me they saw news about the show. And it's a wonderful way to get in touch with old friends.
Yeah. Any chance of touring it or taking it to other
cities? I would hope. You see, in the very beginning of my work with this show, I thought that classes in labor at the universities would be very interested in something like this. And other civic groups, women's rights groups.
History,
absolutely.
College kids.
Yes. So far we've not been able to make, roads in those. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very hard to get people to pay attention. Unless it's something that they need.
That's
so
true.
We'll have to work on that, but I would love to tour with it and do a meeting here or a meeting there or an event, a money-raising event for different organizations.
This would be perfect for that,
I think so.
Yeah.
And it would be a great learning experience because more than half the people I mention, Emma Goldman, they never heard of her.
Yeah, isn't that sad?
And these are people, mature people.
Well, some have a reference to her from Ragtime, the musical, but that's about it.
Yeah. But you see, the United States government and big business and labor, not labor, big business, was so intent on getting rid of her when she was, that they deported her. And she seems to have been erased from history. That's one of the things that piqued my interest. Why was this woman forgotten? Why do they not even mention her?
And why was she such a threat? Because there were a lot of other labor leaders. And she was one of the few that were deported, I think.
She and her lover. Yeah. Alexander Berkman, Sasha. That book just came out, Emma and Sasha. there's more interest in her now. It seems like it's safe, you know, in a romantic way to talk about her life.
But we need to chronicle these people because they're ones that help build America, help shape
absolutely.
America, especially the 20th century.
She, you know, anarchism is a bad word now, and socialism is a bad word. It really isn't, but you know, people take it that way.
Right.
She was very idealistic about these politics. Very idealistic.
But more than just that, tell us about the free love thing. The quote that's in your program.
Well. She believed that anarchism was freedom.
Okay.
It was freedom from oppression. It was freedom from exploitation. And she wanted freedom for women. And she felt this was a natural progression. If you're going to be free, you have to be free to love. Her first lover, Sasha, when she got another boyfriend, said, "You're more to me than a woman. You are my comrade in battle, and that means more. If I believe in freedom, I have to believe in your freedom to love."
Wow.
So
that is very enlightened. That's enlightened for this century, but for more than 100 years
so
ago.
So if you believe in freedom, you have to give other people that freedom as well. And that's what was the tragedy in her life with the lust of her life, I call him, Ben Reitman, Dr. Ben Reitman, Chicagoan. When he proved to be such a rascal, she realized that she couldn't give him the freedom that she said everybody should have freedom in sex. But when he wanted it, she couldn't pay that price. Mm. So you see what comes out, that natural inclination to want to possess someone.
Yeah. So true. You should be very proud of this production.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Tom.
Folks, you got to make sure you go see that. Now let's talk somewhat about your career. You've won a Jeff for Best Actress.
Yes, I have.
Tell us about that.
And that was a labor of love. Bob Falls was directing at the Old Wisdom Bridge Theater. Mm-hmm. He was already becoming the boy wonder. He wanted to do this play, which had been on Broadway, called Wings. About a stroke victim. And she had been an aviatrix in her youth. And he was told, "You will never find anybody in Chicago to do that role." But he was an optimistic young man, and he held auditions, and fortunately I got the part. I loved the part, because this is another thing that was based on a true story. The playwright, Arthur Copit, his father was in a rehabilitation home, and he met this woman and wrote the play about her.
Okay.
And it's a very uplifting play, even though it's a sad situation. And I loved doing it. It was almost a one-woman show. The other characters were shady in the background. It was mostly a lot of her monologues,
okay,
her inner thoughts, because she was not able to speak.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I love doing it. Now, this is the thing that has never ceased to amaze me, Tom. Wisdom Bridge held 90 seats. We had 4 performances a week for 6 weeks. It was 1980. I am consistently approached by people who said, "I saw you in Wings." I don't know how they got that many people in the theater. or for how long.
That's fantastic.
But we were packed every night. It was a wonderful, wonderful story, and I loved doing it. And it was a great thrill.
Wow. And then among all the stuff, I mean, Jim Sherman plays.
Yeah.
You toured with his original play.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well,
Jim, love him as a writer. I think he's terrific.
He's a funny man, and he's a very sweet man.
Yes,
he is.
Oh,
he's a nice guy.
I've interviewed him. He's
fellow.
A good man, yeah.
But our first show, Bo Jest, was a huge success here in Chicago, and then went to New York. We played at the Lamb's Theater off Broadway. The show ran for 2 years. I only stayed 7 months because the other part of my life, my domestic life, it calls me back. I still feel a loyalty that I have to be where my family is.
Of course.
Of course, my husband by that time was retired, so he was able to come and visit New York frequently and stay, you know, for some time. Bernie Landis was my partner.
I remember Bernie. Yeah, good man.
We played
great
husband
actor.
And wife.
Yes.
And we were good buddies. And we toured in other cities, in San Francisco and Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles. Yeah. And we always had a good time. In fact, the young lady who played my daughter in Beau Geste in New York, I fixed her up with another relative. They've been married. They have three lovely children.
So you went to the matchmaker on the
yeah,
also.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
cool.
He came to see her in the play and fell in love.
Great.
Well, anyway, so that was Jim Sherman. I've done, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, I've been thought of as the quintessential Jewish mother since Jim Sherman's plays. I have played all kinds of ethnicities and Yankees and British and many things that were totally the opposite. And yet, those are the plays that people say, oh, you were in Jim Sherman's plays. You were the Jewish mother.
But as long as they remember you, right?
yes, they remember me. But I've been fortunate. I've had a very satisfying career. I've played most of the Equity Theaters in the Chicago area.
And you've done those book readings?
Yes, yeah. I love the spoken word, Tom.
Yeah. Okay, you can sure tell.
My first award was for sonnet reading in college. But, yes, I did classical, short stories for WFMT for years, and I read, at least 12 novels in New York for Recorded Books New York.
Great.
I have about 12 Great. Titles out there.
All right, I'm running out of time, but I have to ask you this question.
Sure.
Because all people I really respect, I ask this. What advice would you give to young actors starting out?
At the risk of being flippant, I would say, first thing you do is marry somebody who's making a living.
Because, interesting.
If you don't have that release from terror at not paying the rent, you'll do better work.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
That's very practical.
The second important thing I would say is when you're starting out, especially if you're moving to another city away from your home, mm-hmm. make sure you get a part-time job, even if it's a volunteer, where they need you, want you, and expect you. Because after all the rejections you'll get from auditions, you have to know there's a place where they want and love you and need you.
That's profound. And that makes sense.
Well, that's how I advised my own granddaughter when she went to California to have an acting career. And she's a brilliant actress, but she ended up as a producer for CNN.
Well, that's not a bad way to go either. Yeah.
So anyway, what I'm saying is you have to protect yourself. Mm-hmm. Because that unsureness, that fear of not making it, will color your performance at an audition.
You know, I know some actors who have suffered from that. They're great if they get a role, but they lose so many roles because they hate the audition process.
Yes, they're afraid.
They're afraid, and the pressure on them because they got to pay the bills.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I tell you, the best thing that I enjoyed about my career was having a domestic life. Because I come out of an audition sometimes thinking, why didn't I ask that question? Why did I make that choice? Oh, if I could only do it over again. I beat myself up until I got the car out of the parking lot. And then I'm thinking, do we have enough milk in the refrigerator? who's doing the carpool tonight? Who's got the car keys? And by the time that comes into my mind, I have released myself from the anxiety of the audition.
That is great advice.
That's why you have to have another life that gives you satisfaction. You have to get rewards somewhere. You know, Tom, I've seen too many young people that come out of an audition or other disappointment, rejection, and they go home to nobody, alone. Why do they drink? Why do they seek sex? Why do they seek drugs? They have to comfort themselves.
Yes, that makes great sense.
So the thing to do is find healthy comfort in a job where they need you, a spouse who wants you. But it's, yes, in order to have that confidence, you go into an audition with confidence if you're halfway there.
Okay. Yeah. That makes great sense. Well, thank you for this, your pearls of wisdom, and folks, you got to go see this show. You are a delight, and the show is terrific. It's so well done.
Thank you.
Folks, thanks for listening, and go see a play this week.